Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. In today's podcast, Dr. Michaela Hofer, PharmD, discusses pathophysiology and treatment options for postpartum depression. With a prevalence ranging from approximately 6 to 13% per delivery, postpartum depression is relatively common, yet pharmacologic treatment options are sparse. After a review of potential treatment barriers, Dr. Hofer will focus on new treatment targets for postpartum depression, including neurotransmitters and neurosteroids, as well as sharing insight on the potential role of brexanolone for this patient population.
Today I'll be talking about postpartum depression. I chose this topic because it's really an under-recognized condition, and it's one that we don't talk about a lot. In fact, when I was doing some research on this topic, I came across a study. It looked at patients presenting to obstetric and gynecologic clinics that screened positive for depression, and looked at these patients to see what was their presenting symptoms, and how often were these patients identified by their OBGYN. They found that less than 60% of patients that screened positive were identified. So obviously it's an under-recognized condition. Additionally, most of these patients that presented with physical complaints or for just general wellness visits. So we can do a better job screening for these patients as well. The other thing that I think is important to understand is that we have not had a lot of great advancements in treatment. Luckily, there is some hope on the horizon, and I'll get to that a little bit later. So first, I'm going to identify the risk factors associated with postpartum depression. From that, talk about our current treatment options and really where the limitations are with those. And then finally, talk about this novel agent, brexanolone, and its potential place in postpartum depression. There's estimates that one in every eight deliveries, a woman will suffer from postpartum depression. Some studies say it's up to every one in every five. Additionally, 20% of these will last past 1 year, the symptoms will, and symptoms can even last into the second year. So obviously this is a prevalent disease that can last much longer than the postpartum period. Anywhere from 40 to 80% of cases are considered moderate to severe, so it can have a significant impact for a prolonged time in a patient's life. The symptoms of postpartum depression are the same as what they are for major depressive disorder. So it's going to be five or more of the following symptoms for greater than 2 weeks. So things you think of like depressed mood, changes in weight, difficulty sleeping, feelings of worthlessness and guilt, also inability to concentrate. What makes it different though than major depressive disorder is the stipulation on onset. So the symptoms are going to occur either during pregnancy or the first 4 weeks following delivery. Now, this is a really key point because a lot of times when we think postpartum depression, we assume this means after delivery. However, a third of the cases will begin in the third trimester. So it's possible patients may still be pregnant when they begin experiencing postpartum depression. Additionally, while the definition in the DSM criteria is the first 4 weeks following delivery, most experts will extend this out to the first year. So it is a wider duration than in this criteria. A lot of times when people think of postpartum depression, they get it confused also with baby blues. And so these are two distinct conditions that I want to go into some detail on. As I alluded to, postpartum depression lasts for longer than 2 weeks, where baby blues are really a transient set of symptoms that typically happen the first few days after delivery. The symptoms are less extreme. They're more emotional lability, nervousness, and difficulty sleeping. Whereas, as we saw with postpartum depression, they're much more extreme, feelings of guilt, lack of enjoyment. Additionally, that difficulty sleeping, a good way to tease it out with postpartum women, since the symptoms typically overlap with depression, are if they have difficulty sleeping while their infant sleeps. Something that surprised me when looking into baby blues was actually the prevalence of it, because 80% of women could suffer from baby blues. I think typically when we think of after birth, we always think, oh, women should be so happy and full of joy. But really, we can see it's quite common to have that emotional reactivity during that time. Typically, there's less dysfunction, and suicide ideation is not present with baby blues, as we could see it with postpartum depression. Baby blues is also a risk factor for developing postpartum depression. Other risk factors include a history of depression or anxiety. So this by far is the strongest risk factor. And it can either be with a previous pregnancy or a non-pregnancy related episode as well. Otherwise, there are environmental risk factors, so financial and marital stress, lack of support or adverse life events, and then previous physical or sexual abuse. Really, we can term this as stress. And there's been a few other risk factors, so younger age, being single, also having multiple births. All of these could be risks for postpartum depression. But why do we really care? What are the effects of postpartum depression? They're multifactorial, and we're going to break it down a little bit. The probably most obvious and most severe, and also quite rare, is maternal suicide. It has been estimated in one study that actually about 20% of postpartum deaths can be attributed to suicide. So while it is rare, it is serious and something to be talked about. On the other end of the spectrum for the mother is also just poor self-care. And so typically, they could have feelings of lack of energy, decreased appetite, leading to weight loss. And so because of this, the mother may not take care of herself as well. Additionally, during this time frame, they're vulnerable, so there's a higher risk for substance abuse. Depressed mothers also have decreased sensitivity to their baby. So by this, it means that mothers may exhibit behaviors that are inconsistent or withdrawing from the child. So really, you could term this as more impaired parenting. It's also been shown that depressed mothers are less likely to engage in playing with their baby, talking with their baby, and having an established routine. And all of those behaviors have been correlated with healthier child developmental outcomes. So because of this, there also may be impaired bonding between the mother and the child, and additionally, perinatal complications. So things like miscarriage and also preeclampsia have been associated. Babies of depressed mothers are more likely to spend time in the NICU after delivery, and they've been shown to have lower Apgar scores. So if you're not familiar with an Apgar score, this is really a method for quickly assessing an infant's health against infant mortality. Babies of depressed mothers have also been shown to have poor adolescent outcomes, everything from lower IQ to more behavioral issues. One study found that babies of depressed mothers had more behavioral disturbances, lower ability to emotionally regulate. And so these are developmental issues that can last much longer than just the postnatal period. And while we think of postpartum depression having obvious effects on the mother and the baby, there's also a wider ramification, and that it can cause extra stress on the family unit and especially marital discord as well. So it affects the whole unit and not just the two players. There's a multifactorial economic burden that comes with postpartum depression. Obviously, maternal suicide plays a major role, but also just loss of work days for the mother as well. So we can see that with postpartum depression, there's a multitude of effects, and it's a very serious disease with a high prevalence. Because of this, screening is so important. I had mentioned previously that in an OBGYN clinic, 60% of patients were not easily identified. And so it's possible if we're not looking for this and we're not being intentional about this, we could miss people. The United States Preventative Service and Task Force recommend screening for all women. They have standard valid tools. These are two very popular ones. You'll be happy to know that I did some research, and here at Mayo, they screen at the first OB visit, at the 28-week visit, at every postnatal visit, and the first six-month wellness visits. So Mayo does a quite thorough job of trying to screen for postpartum depression. So we can screen and we can identify these patients, but if our patients don't have access to resources and treatment, then we haven't made much impact. One resource that I found I wanted to bring your attention to because I thought it was just a really great tool for our patients. It's this website called Postpartum Support International. It's patient-friendly, and it has a variety of resources, everything from what to do in an emergency all the way to finding local support. There's also individual areas for moms, families, fathers. So there's just a variety of tools for patients to use in patient-friendly language. So something I wanted you to be aware of. So we can get them resources, but treatment is our next obstacle. One study showed that less than 15% of mothers with postpartum depression will actually receive treatment. This is because there are several different barriers. The first being one I've alluded to, the difficulty of diagnosis. Many of the symptoms of postpartum depression overlap with the symptoms of new motherhood. So difficulty sleeping, maybe not eating as well. So teasing out that the difference is important. Luckily, we have very trained clinicians that are keyed into a few slight differences. So like I said, can you sleep while the baby sleeps? Are you more cognitively, is it more difficulty concentrating? Things like that are more indicative of postpartum depression than just new motherhood. Another barrier is stigma. So a lot of times when we think of having a new child, we think, again, this is a happy time, this is a joyful time. And so mothers, when they don't feel that way, it's possible they can be embarrassed and not want to seek treatment out of that embarrassment. Some women are even afraid of losing their child. It's a fear, maybe an unjustified one, but still a fear. And then finally, a lot of new mothers will actually minimize their symptoms. So this is everything from, this is normal, all mothers go through this, to the other spectrum of just, I can power through this, I can deal with this on my own. Because of these reasons, many women won't seek treatment for their postpartum depression. This brings us to our first question. So you can respond at pollev.com/MayoRx or text MayoRx in all caps to 22333. Which of the following is the strongest risk factor for developing postpartum depression? Multiparity, prenatal depression, age less than 25 years at delivery, or a lack of social support? So it looks like the majority says prenatal depression. All of the risk factors for postpartum depression. But yes, the strongest risk factor by far is the prenatal depression or anxiety. So anyone with a history of depression or anxiety, either in a previous pregnancy or just an episode not related, those are they're at the highest risk for developing postpartum depression. Before we can get into treatment, I think it's good to have an understanding of the pathophysiology of postpartum depression because it's complex. It's not one cause, but it's actually a multitude of interconnecting pathways. There have been family, twin, and GWAS studies, so genome studies, looking at the correlation between genetics and epigenetics, which is the environmental's effect on genes, in regards to postpartum depression. You'll recognize a few of these genes as areas that we see in other forms of depression. Really, the most interesting fact, though, with looking at the genetic markers, is they found that these genes were most correlated with women if they also had an environmental stressor as well. So it seems like women may have a genetic predisposition based on their genes, but they still need that extra effect of the environmental stressor to then have the episode of postpartum depression. Again, just pointing to that this is a complex system. Most people are familiar with neurotransmitters as it relates to depression. So things like serotonin, as we say, are SSRIs, SNRIs. There have been many studies looking at this in postpartum depression as well. They have found conflicting evidence with different levels between GABA and glutamate. However, it does seem clear that there is some role that neurotransmitters play in postpartum depression. When it comes to neurosteroids, I'm going to focus on one called allopregnanolone. This is a metabolite of progesterone. It has been looked at as it has anti-anxiety and antidepressant effects. Also, it's been known to rise during pregnancy and then abruptly fall after delivery. It's been correlated that when levels fall, animal models have increased symptoms of depression-like behaviors. Additionally, when we look at patients with major depressive disorder, so not postpartum, but major depressive disorder, they have lower levels. And after antidepressant treatment, their levels actually rise. So there is some theory that allopregnanolone may play a role in postpartum depression. An obvious potential factor is looking at reproductive hormones. We know that when it comes to pregnancy, levels rise and then fall dramatically after delivery. And because of this, these have been studied extensively. There's been some conflicting literature, but for the most part, it is hypothesized that it does play a role, especially because we know that estrogen signaling has an effect on stress pathways, also thought to play a role in postpartum depression. There's been a lot of interest in looking at the corticotropin-releasing hormone as a biomarker for postpartum depression. Unfortunately, there's been some conflicting evidence with that, so at this time it can't be used as a reliable marker, but there'll be more research on it. I included neuroinflammation more for completeness sake. There has been studies that correlate both pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory markers. However, these are really newer studies, and we don't have any strong conclusions at this time. And then finally, there's also been some evidence to support circuit level changes. So for example, differences in white matter connectivity in the brain that's correlated with postpartum depression. But again, this is more in its infancy of research, and so more hypothesis generating, but no clear correlations. So typically we want our treatment targets to target our pathophysiology. When we look at our genetic markers, while we have some data to support certain genetic markers, we have no indicated treatments that specifically target those genes. As for neurotransmitters, our SSRIs, SNRIs, we can use those in postpartum depression, and those are most common. Moving on, for neurosteroids, we don't have any FDA-approved treatments targeting neurosteroids at this time. There's been studies looking at both estrogen, progesterone, and oxytocin in treating postpartum depression. However, they've had conflicting results, and so more evidence is needed before we can recommend its use. There's also been no approved treatments targeting either the stress hormones, neuroinflammation, or circuit level changes. So while we know that it is a multifactorial pathophysiology, we really only have one treatment target at this time, and that's neurotransmitters. There's only been a few randomized controlled trials really looking at the use of antidepressants in postpartum depression. I'm going to spend a little bit of time now going through a few of those. The first trial ever done was looking at the use of fluoxetine in cognitive behavioral therapy in postpartum depression. These women were not pregnant, so this was postnatal, postpartum depression. And really, they looked at a few different interventions of fluoxetine versus placebo in different counseling sessions. I'm going to focus more on what they found with fluoxetine versus placebo. They looked at a difference between fluoxetine and placebo on a revised clinical interview schedule. This is just an assessment for diagnosis. It's not one we typically use anymore, so most people aren't familiar with it. But they did find a significant difference benefiting the use of fluoxetine with or on the clinical interview schedule. So this was really our first trial showing that antidepressants are likely beneficial in treating postpartum depression. Another trial that was done in 2006 was looking at sertraline versus nortriptyline, so now two different classes of antidepressants, to see if one is potentially more effective than another. It was a double-blind randomized controlled trial that looked at postpartum depression. Again, these are women that were not pregnant. They were postnatal at this time. And what they did was they looked at response and remission on the Hamilton score, Hamilton rating scale. They again found that there was a significant benefit favoring the antidepressants versus placebo. However, there was not a significant difference between the two antidepressants. So at this point, it looks like they're both effective, but one wasn't more effective than the other. Looking at safety, they found a similar side effect burden, but different side effects. So this really came about pointing us in the direction that if antidepressants are going to have similar efficacy, we should probably try to pick our antidepressants then more based on side effects. So avoiding things that could exacerbate pregnancy-like symptoms. And then finally, there was a review done in 2014 that again looked at postpartum depression, so women that were not pregnant. We don't have studies in women that, randomized controlled trials in women that were still pregnant during postpartum depression. Anyways, this trial looked at a few different antidepressants, sertraline, paroxetine, fluoxetine, versus placebo. And really what they found, again showing that antidepressants are effective compared to placebo in treating postpartum depression. However, there's not enough evidence to conclude if antidepressants are more effective than psychotherapy, so like talk therapy, or if there's a more effective antidepressant than another, how long we should actually be treating for, and any effect in breastfeeding. This is really where we're at with postpartum depression then, is that we know antidepressants can be effective, but we still have a multitude of questions on how to really utilize them best. Now when we're thinking about patients that have postpartum depression that starts while they're still pregnant, navigating those waters is going to be a lot of extrapolated data from both our trials that we have in postpartum depression after delivery, but also looking at studies that were done on women that were started on antidepressants before they were pregnant and then continued on. So lower quality of evidence, but it's the best we can do at this point in time. Because of this, we have certain treatment considerations from this other literature. One thing to consider is teratogenic effect of antidepressants. And so there's been some studies that point to a potential association of things like septal defects with the use of paroxetine. There's been more literature out that also conflicts this, and also persistent pulmonary hypertension with SSRI use. A really key point, though, of this is that these studies were done, and these effects were mostly seen in first trimester pregnancies. So can we really extrapolate it to third trimester? It's a question for discussion, and it's why I pointed it more of a potential association. Additionally, there's some potential for obstetric effects. So women or babies born with mothers that were on antidepressants have been shown to potentially have some more preterm delivery, be smaller for gestational age, and lower Apgar scores. With that said, the clinical significance of these outcomes is unknown. And there's been some data supporting that women are at a higher risk for postpartum hemorrhage due to the serotonergic effect of drugs. Developmental effects have been associated. However, this brings up a really good point of that when we're looking at women that are pregnant antidepressants, there's a lot of confounding variables. One of the confounders is untreated depression. So as I've already alluded to in our effects slide of untreated postpartum depression, babies born of women that are not treated can have developmental effects long term. So is it possible that in these studies, the babies were exposed to the antidepressant is because antidepressant, or is it possible because the depression was not adequately controlled? It's something that we don't have the answer to at this point in time. And then finally, there has been a stronger association that a baby might suffer from neonatal adaption syndrome after delivery. What this is really transient and mild symptoms that are short term. So these can typically be things like jitteriness, difficulty sleeping, potentially hypoglycemia. For the most part, these are managed symptom-wise. The most serious side effect can be respiratory depression that requires some sort of intervention, but that is quite rare and typically treatment with oxygen would suffice if that even occurs. The cause is unknown. It's that it could either be due to antidepressant withdrawal or side effects. It could even be due to preterm birth or genetic factors, so a little more peripherally correlated with antidepressant use. But again, really all we do is we monitor these babies for a couple extra days and then treat their symptoms if they arise. So to summarize our treatment considerations, really what's important is to first determine if the woman is still pregnant or not. If it's pregnant, we will have some considerations for the developing fetus. But like I said, a lot of our data has been extrapolated, and there's just a lot of confounding variables with that. One really good pearl is that if a woman has been previously treated effectively with an antidepressant, it is best to go to that one first. We know that it'll be efficacious and likely, depending on which agent it is, it's probably safe. But again, I'll get to some resources here in a little bit of how to check for sure. Otherwise, if this was a new diagnosis, SSRIs and SNRIs are first line. As I've alluded to, since we don't know which agent is more effective than another or class, really pick an agent based on side effect profile. So for example, it might be better to stay away from our nortriptyline or TCAs because they might be more constipating, they might cause more orthostatic hypertension, hypotension, so symptoms that pregnant women might already face and just may exacerbate. Minimize the number of exposures, so really maximize one agent before adding in something else. And then finally, if a woman was successfully treated during pregnancy, it's safe to continue the medication during lactation as the baby was exposed to much higher levels in utero than they would be through the breast milk. There are a lot of really great resources out there. Micromedex actually has access to three different ones. I would encourage you to spend some time playing around with it later today. But really, these are good for looking at teratogenic side effects of medications in healthcare professional language. Most people are familiar with LactMed, so looking more specifically at medications in lactation. Mother to Baby is an interesting website. I think it's a really good tool and one that our patients will have access to. It's in patient-friendly language, and it seems to have very high-quality evidence. However, their resources are a little bit, or references are a little bit harder to find, so I wouldn't use that as my first go-to or really as my primary, but more for initial information or to see what patients have access to. And then finally, MotherRisk is also a really great website. It has patient-friendly language, but also great references to go along with it as well. The biggest factor that I want to talk about, though, in antidepressant use, or I guess treatment in general for postpartum depression, is that it is a major time commitment. It takes weeks for efficacy, either with antidepressants or psychotherapy. As you can see here, anywhere from 4 to 6, psychotherapy alone can take 8 to 20 sessions. So really, this big time commitment means prolonged suffering for our mothers. I'm going to come to our next question now. So I'll be asking you what the most appropriate treatment is. MC is a 31-year-old female recently diagnosed with postpartum depression. She was successfully treated during her previous pregnancy with citalopram. She would like to breastfeed. Which of the following would be the most appropriate treatment for MC? So fluoxetine, 20 milligrams daily, nortriptyline, 50 milligrams daily, sertraline, 25 daily, or citalopram, 20 daily. So it looks like it's unanimous for citalopram, 20 daily. And I think everyone got the point I was trying to make. Well, all of these could be appropriate. Really, the best answer is going to be citalopram because this was the agent she was previously effectively treated on. So now she has a better chance at being successfully treated again. As I've alluded to, one of the major downfalls with our current treatment options are that we really only target one pathophysiological mechanism, and it takes a long time to get efficacy. So I want to bring back on the table the use of allopregnanolone, a neurosteroid. Allopregnanolone is a metabolite of progesterone. So as we know, the levels will increase in pregnancy and then drop dramatically at delivery. So it has been targeted. Really, though, what it is an allosteric modulator of GABA-A. So GABA-A is a chloride ion, and chloride will go through it. When allopregnanolone binds, it opens the channel longer and with increased frequency. So it's different than, say, benzodiazepines or barbiturates. Benzodiazepines typically increase the frequency of opening the channel, and barbiturates increase the duration it's open, whereas allopregnanolone does both. Brexanolone is the exogenous form of allopregnanolone. So there's been a few trials. The most recent phase 3 trial occurred in postpartum women, so women that were not pregnant. They looked at both moderate and severe postpartum depression, and they excluded women with a history of psychiatric illness, also women with suicide in the most recent episode of depression. They had two different studies. So study one is looking at severe postpartum depression with two different doses of brexanolone. Study two was looking at moderate postpartum depression versus placebo. The interesting thing about brexanolone is it's actually a 60-hour infusion, so a little bit different than most of our medications. Their primary outcome was a change from baseline in the HAM-D score, so a tool assessing depression, and they followed up to 30 days. Before I get to the efficacy, there's a couple points I wanted to draw out from the baseline characteristics. The first being that a third of their patients had onset of symptoms in, 20 to 30% had onset of symptoms in the third trimester. So again, pointing to the fact that it is possible for women to have symptoms starting in the third trimester. Additionally, in these trials, about 20% of patients had antidepressant use either previously or while they're still on brexanolone. So when we think about how we're going to potentially apply this medication moving forward, it's important to have that information. So efficacy, what we really care about. So this is looking at the change in HAM-D score, so the change from baseline. The brexanolone doses are in pink and blue, with the higher dose being in pink. And they found that there was a significant difference with the use of brexanolone while the drug was still infusing, and it was sustained out to 30 days. So they found efficacy in severe depression against placebo. When looking at study two, or moderate postpartum depression, they again found a significant difference favoring brexanolone while the drug was still infusing. However, they didn't see that sustained effect out to 30 days like they did with the severe postpartum depression. For the most part, it was well tolerated. The most common side effects of brexanolone are headache, dizziness, somnolence, so things that we could expect with something that would alter GABA transmission. However, there was also three serious side effects that led to loss of consciousness. So again, a potential relationship with the GABA transmission. But because of that, while it was up for FDA approval, the FDA asked instead to have a REMS program put in place to address this loss of consciousness. They're expected to have a decision later in March, so we'll find out. There was an almost unanimous vote previously in the fall to recommend to approve brexanolone, so people have high suspicion it will be approved, but at this point in time, it's not FDA indicated. One of the issues with brexanolone, though, is because it's such a unique drug that there are logistic implications if it were to be approved and implemented. So for example, it's going to be need to be administered inpatient. And so really, who's going to own this drug? Is it going to be the OB unit or is psychiatry going to own it? Where would this patient be housed and have the drug administered? The company says that there will be need to have monitoring by an RN or higher. So again, they'll have to be more staff or potentially more resource-heavy medication to use. And the drug would like that there be space for both mom and baby. So just finding the logistics of where this can be housed is important. Additionally, each IV bag needs to be made separately, as the expiration date only lasts for 12 hours after it's reconstituted. And so again, this is really potentially a resource-heavy medication, and so there'll have to be a lot of thought put into its implication or its implementation if it were to be approved. So at this point, what is the place in therapy for brexanolone? Brexanolone should be administered to all patients for prevention of postpartum depression, should be used as treatment for all severities of postpartum depression, should be used solely for treatment of severe postpartum depression, or should not be used for prevention nor treatment of postpartum depression. All right, so it looks like most people say should be used solely for treatment of severe postpartum depression. There's really not a right answer for this one. I think it's more to have you think about what we think the role would be. So yes, we saw efficacy with the treatment of severe, so that makes the most sense. We don't know, though, for sure that it wouldn't aid in prevention of postpartum depression. So I think logistically speaking, it'll be interesting to see how we implement it. And probably my opinion would be that treatment of severe postpartum depression, we'll see, as it's not quite yet approved either. So to summarize today, due to stigma and difficulty of diagnosis, postpartum depression is underdiagnosed but a treatable disease. The largest risk factor is a history of anxiety or depression. First-line treatment typically includes an SSRI or an SNRI. However, if a patient was previously effectively treated with an antidepressant, that one should be our go-to. Brexanolone is a novel agent currently undergoing the approval process to be the first medication indicated for the treatment of postpartum depression. I mean, we should know later in March what the decision is. And then finally, I think this is a key point in that a pharmacist can play a major role in guiding therapy plans in this condition. As you saw, their evidence can be murky, and so I think a pharmacist can help wade through some of that confusion and also think mechanistically to come up with appropriate recommendations.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.